intended. This program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources. Let's start with some articles from AARP, the magazine. This one is entitled A Better Place, and it's under the heading of This is 70. A Father Reflects on Loss. This is by Ted Gupp. It's that time again to write Michael Collins a check to mow and weed my father's grave. I pay him $250 a year. My father was felled by a heart attack 51 years ago. He was 50. I was 23. It still gives me something of a start to climb that hill in Canton, Ohio's West Lawn Cemetery and come up on his grave, to see his name, my name, Theodore Gupp, etched into the granite, reminds me of that scene in Dickens' A Christmas Carol when Scrooge stands before his own grave. A wave of regrets washes over him, and he resolves to mend his selfish ways. Only in fiction are such redos possible. Real life offers few mulligans. I am now 74, and rounding the final turn myself. Death, once so remote and abstract, is now neither. Early on, I knew that our family's Jewish traditions forbade a child from being named after a living parent. I was told it was out of fear that the angel of death would take the child out of turn. My father's defiance tempted fate. I am no more religious than my father was. Still, my wife and I did not name our firstborn Theodore. Instead, we called him David. It means beloved, and beloved he surely was. But at 21, David was snatched away by a drug overdose, and I was condemned to carry on. I lived that cliché, no parent should have to bury a child. And for years, I knew that was how others saw me. The bereft and broken father, the embodiment of unspoken fears. In all things, David colored outside the lines. For that, others were drawn to him as to a magnet, and he was smart. He could barely pass his own exams, but at the end of each semester, signing in as one friend or another, he would take their exams for them and ace them. Among the papers found at the foot of his bed, I came across an interview between David and a friend of mine, a best-selling author. It vividly captured her personality and made me proud. There was so much promise there. Years later, I discovered he had never spoken with her. After he had partied his way through 4 years of college without graduating, David spent a summer in Honduras working with the poor. He was, I believed, at last on the right path and out of peril. But I felt it was time for him to buckle down. When I took him back to college that fall, my parting words to David, shaking hands on the sidewalk outside his apartment, were, "Finish strong." 2 days later, the call from the coroner. I remember being handed his ashes. The funeral director cautioned my wife that the cremated remains were heavy, as if to prepare her for the impossible wait. In one sense, the funeral director was right. They were heavy, heavier than expected. But then, compared to our son, they were unfathomably light, a preposterous exchange for the man-boy in whom we had invested our hopes and dreams. We never scattered David's ashes, but recently I have been thinking of finding a place for them in the woods beside our cabin in Maine. He liked it there, where we might put a bench and some plantings, and reflect upon David and upon the days we might have before us and what we should make of them. I have never been able to believe that David is in a better place now than when he was here with us, but I would at least be able to say he's in a better place than the shelf where his ashes are now. I think he would appreciate the sarcasm. In one sense, I no longer grieve for either my father or my son. Yes, I miss their company, but but I am no longer consumed by the unfairness of their passing. I imagine them urging me to live. Every time I say or write my name, I invoke my father's spirit. And every day the memory of my David returns to me, full of mischief and guile and irrepressible joy. I suppose I, too, am now in a better place. Ted Gupp teaches at Swarthmore College and is the author of several nonfiction books. And now we're going to the Psychology Now issue. And last week we talked about keeping secrets. And there were a couple of sidebar articles that I didn't read to you at the time, so we're going to do those now. Who to trust with secrets? If you have a secret that you need to tell someone, then it can be hard to decide who to reveal it all to. It should be someone you trust, who would have your best interest at heart, and not spread your secret further. This could be a family member or a friend, depending on the nature of the secret. Consider how the person you're speaking to might be impacted themselves about the secret. If it's related to a mutual friend, for example, you may be placing an unfair burden on them. So someone neutral can be a better choice. Also, consider what you're looking to achieve by telling your secret. Do you need advice, compassion, understanding? Some people will be better off to offer this than others. Maybe they have some experience that will place them in a good position to help you. Or maybe they are just fair and kind, and you know they won't judge you. When you do speak to them, offer a choice. Don't just spill your secret, but first ask them if they are comfortable being your confidant and keeping your secret. And then the other one is, can you keep a secret? Now, this one has multiple choice answers, so you should keep track as we go along where you go, and then I'll tell you how you scored. Trusted confidant or chronic overshare? Take our quiz to find out how you like to communicate. Among your friends, you would describe yourself as A, the quiet one, B, the one who asks questions, C, the wise one, D, the gossip. A friend tells you a secret. You, A, take it to your grave, obviously. B, share it with your therapist for her thoughts. C, tell your partner if it's important. D, tell other friends on the down low. 3. How often do you share your opinion on something? A, never. B, occasionally. C, only when asked. D, always. I'm entitled to it. Next, you meet a new person. How do you react? A, you're guarded. B, ask them questions about their life. C, chat freely. D, tell them about yourself first. Next, how often do you tend to post on social media? A, hardly ever. B, once a week, maybe. C, every few days. D, every day. And finally, how would your colleagues describe you? A, closed off and shy. B, you're friendly but keep to yourself. C, easy to talk to. D, loud and bordering on disruptive. Now, how did you score? Mostly A's. A secret keeper. You'd much rather observe a situation than participate, even when someone asks you. You're pretty reluctant to share any private information. It's totally okay to be private, but some people might think you're ignorant, which isn't the case. Why are you closed off? Do you need to learn to trust yourself? Mostly B's, the quizzer. You're fairly active in conversations and like to ask questions. You're curious about other people, but don't give much back. People may find it difficult to trust you, and your relationships might not be as strong as they could be. Share your feelings and start feeling connected. This would help professionally, too. Mostly C's, chatty chum. You know exactly what you would like to share and what you keep private. This is good behavior for your friendships and professional life. But are you being authentic or doing it to keep the peace? People like you or people like you for you. So try to keep a conversation flowing naturally rather than faking it according to the situation. And mostly D's, chronic oversharer. You're an open book, more than confident, chatting to new people and sharing with others. However, it often borders on inappropriate, and you tend to overshare. Learn what works for each situation. How good a friend are you if you share secrets so easily? Think about how you would like to be treated before speaking. Now, back to AARP the magazine. A spring health special. We're a little late this spring, but it'll be appropriate. See me, hear me, feel me. How growing older changes our ability to see, hear, taste, smell, and even touch. By the time we hit our mid to late 60s, about one in four of us will have noticed that at least one significant change in how we see the world. It's becoming cloudier. For many of us, that change in our sight, a result of cataracts, a breakdown of the proteins in the eye that then clump together, obscuring our vision, can truly affect our quality of life. But it should also be a wake-up call about protecting the delicate systems that give us our sight, hearing, touch, smell, and taste. Indeed, by age 64, more than half of us will have measurable impairment in two or more of these senses, one study suggests. And while much of the decline in our senses can be slowed or stopped with early detection and treatment, the damage we sustain usually can't be reversed. We consulted some of the leaders in research and treatment to uncover what's really happening to our ability to sense the world and what we can do to protect it and ensure that we are enjoying life to its fullest for years to come. How to see your future more clearly. This week we'll deal with vision. Sam Baker of Scottsdale, Arizona, noticed his vision deteriorating as he reached his 80s. Now a healthy 102, the World War II vet is struggling with wet, age-related macular degeneration, which has impeded on his recent venture, writing children's books. "Losing my eyesight means my eyes tire faster," said Baker. "I've almost stopped reading. I'm listening to books and watching a large screen TV." He currently takes three different medicated eye drops to help manage his condition. Eye diseases are increasingly common as we age, but diligent monitoring can play a crucial role in holding on to your vision. What to expect in your 70s and beyond? It's a myth that as you get older, you should expect to lose vision, says Christiana Y. Wing, M.D., Fellowship Program Director of Vitreoretinal Diseases and Surgery at the Baylor College of Medicine Cullen Eye Institute in Houston. While age-related changes occur and the risk of adverse eye conditions increases, regularly monitoring and timely treatments can help most of us protect our sight well into our later years. Close reading stabilizes. Presbyopia, from a Greek term meaning old eye, is a stiffening of the lenses that makes it harder to focus on close-up tasks, says Chantal Quesino-Krieger, M.D., an ophthalmologist at the National Eye Institute. This condition usually begins to stabilize in our 60s. That means now might be the best time to really address the issue. Depending on how old you are. Reading glasses or multifocal lenses are the obvious solutions. Surgery, such as monovision, LASIK, is an option, although any permanent change in vision can have unintended side effects, like altered depth perception. And while there are eye drops that reduce your pupil size and can help your eyes focus up close for up to 6 hours, they too have potential downsides, including red eye, headaches, and reduced night vision. Koisino Krieger offers her own hack for reading small type. Snap a photo of it on your smartphone and then zoom in. our eyes get dry. Visually, everyone over 55 has some degree of dryness, says Alan Carlson, MD, professor of ophthalmology at Duke University School of Medicine in Durham, North Carolina. For some, this may result in dry eye syndrome, in which the eyes don't produce enough tears or the tears evaporate too quickly. Spending time on our phones and computers can worsen the condition, since we tend to blink less when we're staring at a screen. Over-the-counter eye drops, and in some cases prescription medications, can help, as can avoiding air blowing in your eyes from fans or air conditioners. Take breaks from the screen, drink plenty of fluids, and consider using a humidifier in both your home and office. Sunglasses help because both wind and sunlight can cause the fluid in your eyes to evaporate faster than it can be replaced. Ask your doctor to check your medications, as antihistamines and blood pressure drugs may also contribute to dry eyes. The world may look a bit duller. Cataracts tend to grow slowly, but by age 75 to 79, about half of people will have them. They affect 7 in 10 people, 80 and above. Fortunately, cataract surgery is one of the most common procedures in the world, with 3.7 million performed each year in the U.S. It involves swapping out the cloudy lens of the eye with an artificial one. A potential upside, you may be a candidate for an artificial lens that could allow you to ditch your glasses and contacts. It gets harder to see at night. As we grow older, our eyes begin to lose the photoreceptors, called rods, that enable us to see in low light. At the same time, the muscles that control our pupils weaken, causing our pupils to get smaller. After age 60, we may need 3 times as much light to see as we did in our 30s. Our vision may get spotty, too. As the jelly-like fluid that fills the eye breaks down with age, spots in your vision called floaters can appear. They are typically harmless, says Natasha Hertz, MD, a clinical spokesperson for the American Academy of Ophthalmology. But if you notice a sudden onset of a cloud of floaters, get checked out immediately for a retinal tear or detachment, which would need to be repaired within 24 to 48 hours to prevent permanent damage. Our risk of eye disease increases. Glaucoma, which can lead to blindness from optic nerve damage, is most commonly diagnosed in one's 70s or 80s and is often asymptomatic. Regular screening can catch it early, which is crucial to stopping its progression. The same is true for age-related macular degeneration, AMD. The leading cause of vision loss in the U.S. in people over 60. 3 in 10 of those 80 and above have signs of early AMD. Dry AMD is caused by a breakdown in the macula, a part of the retina. Although it cannot be prevented or cured, its progression may be slowed by a specific blend of vitamins and minerals called AREDS2. A second, less common form is wet AMD, in which abnormal blood vessels leak fluid into the macula, which degrades vision. Treatment involves injections into the eye itself to slow the progression of the disease. Finally, if you have diabetes, regular eye exams are even more crucial, as diabetic retinopathy, a result of damage to the blood vessels of the eye, can be treated and sometimes reversed if caught early, says Kimberly Karachi, an optometrist at Cleveland Clinic in Florida. Now, the sidebar here, protect your eyes. Take a good look at these tips for saving your vision. Now, if you're still smoking, quit. Smokers are 2 to 3 times more likely to develop cataracts and up to 4 times more likely to develop AMD than non-smokers. Call 800-QUIT-NOW for help. Daily, wear sunglasses or a wide-brimmed hat outdoors. It's estimated that at least 15 million people worldwide are blind from cataracts. Approximately 10% of them may be due to UV exposure. Sunlight can also exacerbate AMD and even put you at risk for skin cancer in the eye. Get moving. Getting your heart pumping and more oxygen and blood flowing to your eyes can reduce your risk of glaucoma by up to 73%. Eat your veggies. A 2024 study showed that eating even a modest amount of green leafy vegetables, at least 2.7 servings a week, slowed the progression of age-related macular degeneration. Prioritize sleep. Even one night of poor sleep can cause reduced tear production that could exacerbate dry eyes. And control your blood sugar. Diabetes can lead to vision issues, but with monitoring, they can be treated and sometimes even reversed. And yearly, get a comprehensive eye exam. That means having your eyes dilated and examined, not just checking your prescription for glasses. The American Optometric Association suggests having this done at least one or every 2 years. And next time, we'll look at your ears. Now we're going to start another article from this same magazine today, which we won't get through, but we'll give it a start. Rob Lowe is a Brat Pack heartthrob, B, trivia quiz answer, C, lifelong dog lover, D, thriving game show host, E, all of the above. This is by Nicole Pager. Look, says Rob Lowe excitedly, pointing to a pod of dolphins jumping in the waves. We're spending the morning in Lowe's adopted hometown of Santa Barbara, California. Lowe, who surfs every chance he gets and lives just down the beach, has seen dolphins numerous times, but it turns out that the trademark enthusiasm he brings to many of his roles is true to life. You would think this was his very first sighting. It's a rare day off for Lowe, who is recording episodes of his popular podcast, Literally, with Rob Lowe, hosting season 3 of Fox's trivia game, The Floor, and working on his third book. I figured out how to write 2 books about me, he jokes about his memoirs. My wife likes to say, no one likes talking about themselves more than you do, and I'm happy to admit to that. The working title for Lowe's next book is What Do I Know? A Guide to Living, which he hopes will land him in the self-help section of the bookstore. It's my truisms, and about what I found to work, what I found to not work, what I've observed, and what I think, he shares. In addition to gaining time by the sea, he's reveling in the chance to log quality time with his 5 pups. They arrive on leashes, guided by their trainer. Your dogs love you no matter what the ratings are, he deadpans. She slept with us last night, he says, giving his black Russell Terrier, Daisy, an affectionate rub. It is no coincidence he narrated the winsome 2024 Netflix documentary, Inside the Mind of a Dog. Lowe burst onto the scene as Soda Pop Curtis in Francis Ford Coppola's The Outsiders and continued to dominate 1980s coming-of-age films, St. Elmo's Fire, About Last Night, to cement his place in Hollywood's Brat Pack. Throughout the 90s, he worked on dozens of TV projects and other movies with parts small and large, including in Wayne's World, Contact, and Austin Powers movies, among the better known. Then, in 1999, he pivoted to prestige television, earning Emmy and Golden Globe nominations for his role as Sam Seaborn in The West Wing. Since then, he has done a star turn in Parks and Recreation, voiced animated characters, and given audiences an intimate look into his life through a one-man show, Stories I Only Tell My Friends Live. More recently, he has worked alongside the younger of his 2 sons, John Owen, to create and star in the eccentric comedy Unstable, which blurs the lines between the real and fictional father-son relationship, and played a firehouse chief in the Fox first responder drama 911 Lone Star. At 61, Lowe still looks very much like the teen heartthrob America fell in love with in The Outsiders. His famously chiseled jawline is just as prominent, his piercing blue eyes still as welcoming. Jeans, yes, he says, but he also gives a shout-out to his decision to become sober 35 years ago. Meanwhile, his latest TV series, Unstable and Lone Star, were canceled last year after 2 and 5 season runs, respectively. But once again, Lowe had already made a calculated shift, this time to become a game show host, first on the since-shelved Fox show Mental Samurai, and now on The Floor, which premiered its 3rd season in February. The gig, a trivia face-off show that begins with 100 contestants on set, is challenging. But Lowe has made it work. I'm an air traffic controller, contestant whisperer, coach, scorekeeper, and one-man show, he says. You have to do it all at once and make it look easy. I love it. When asked if he has purposely made himself uncategorizable, he suggests it's more about staying in the spotlight. Attention spans are only getting shorter, says Lowe. I've run into enough young people who don't know who Paul Newman is, so I'm aware of how fleeting a person's memories can be. And he has no plans to slow down anytime soon. Retiring on a bench somewhere is definitely not in the cards. I want to find new things that are continually challenging me and reintroducing me to people who might not have been born when The West Wing came out, he explains. Besides, I love trivia. And now, for the rest of Rob Lowe's life, via a dozen trivia questions. Where did Rob Lowe acquire his boyish Midwestern charm? In Dayton, Ohio. Lowe caught the acting bug at about age 10 when his parents took him to see a family friend in a Dayton production of Oliver. It was an aha experience, he says. He auditioned and landed the lead in a play at the Dayton Playhouse, and that was that. It's a sense of being seen, he says, a sense of power and ability. I felt it the very first time I went on stage, and I got a laugh. Lowe took acting seriously, an interest uncommon in the Midwest in the 1970s. I took a lot of grief for it, he says ruefully. He sought ways to stand out and get ahead. At age 11, he was with his mother in a hotel lobby when he saw luggage tagged with Liza Minnelli's name. 2 years earlier, she had won the Oscar for Cabaret. Well, we have to stop now, but we'll continue next time. Well, folks, we have run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure and listen again at the same time next week. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.